Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Looking for beyond ordinary investment opportunities? Global X ETFs is here to help with their suite of thematic, income, commodity, and digital asset funds. Explore the range at globalxetfs.com.au. And now, on with the show. How are you now? Broadcasting from the VFS studios in Milsons Point in Sydney. You're listening to the all-new BIP Show, Season 7, Episode 7. I'm going to stop saying it's the all-new BIP Show. It's just the BIP Show as it is now. Thank you very much to Global X for all of their work sponsoring the BIP Show. Fantastic stuff. Check them out. If you can, check out the podcast that I did with Blair Hannon a couple of weeks ago on clean tech. We might touch on that today as well. We'll see how we go. Don't forget that everything in this podcast is the advice, whatever you want to hear it, is general in nature. You know the difference. If you don't, speak to a professional advisor about your needs. If you want to speak to a professional advisor about your needs, then come and talk to me. My name is James Whelan. I'm the investment manager here at VFS Group. This episode is being recorded in Sydney. It is 9:35 Australian Eastern Daylight Time on the 10th of March, 2023 AD. My guest today, and we're going back to back, ANZ. I'm going to get a call from Shane. He's going to want to sponsor the show. Daniel Hines, Senior Commodity Strategist with the ANZ, coming in off the coattails of the wonderful Adelaide Timbrell last week, who was just sensational. Daniel, how are you now?
I'm good, James. How are you?
Yeah, not so bad. Are you okay with the coattails of Adelaide?
No. She's a hard act to follow. She's really good on this stuff, but I'll do my best.
Yeah, good on you. Now, look, we're going to go through it really quickly today. A few of the notes that I've seen from you lately, just over the last couple of months, you've talked about iron ore, you've talked about natural gas, you've talked about oil in the perspective, and over the last few, the last few weeks, talking about Chinese reopening, where you see commodity prices. It does seem quite bullish. I want to go through that under the context of the Chinese at the National People's Congress on Sunday that just started. With their outlook of being subdued, I think is probably the word, of talking about a general sort of term, vague above 5% growth this year, which is better than last year, but is definitely nowhere near where Chinese growth has been in the past. So if we can just go into that. First off, do you want to kick off with oil? The note that you've got on the 9th of February, you see Brent back above 100 bucks a barrel for the first half of 2023. Do you still, obviously, that was all based, a fair chunk of that was based on Chinese demand coming back online. Do you want to talk to that and sort of see how that's switched around, Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly switched around quite dramatically late last year. I mean, looking into this year prior to the Chinese reopening, I mean, there were plenty of issues and headwinds for the market, in particular, for advanced economies. Obviously, the high inflationary environment did create this backdrop, I suppose, of weaker growth as those central banks tighten monetary policy. So it looked rather uncertain. But I think the Chinese reopening their economy there was a bit of a game changer, and clearly, with less restrictions on mobility, you're going to see a pretty sharp reversal of oil demand after a pretty lackluster year, as you would have expected. So, that obviously changed things around quite dramatically. I suppose in the midst of these ongoing supply side issues now, I think the market, and certainly myself is included in this, have been surprised by how well Russia has been able to mitigate the loss of Europe as a customer with increased exports to Asia in particular. And that has, I suppose, softened the outlook somewhat. I think you know, most people were expecting some pretty tight markets as a result of the potential shutout of Russian oil. As I said, that hasn't eventuated. And in fact, we've had to see, you know, further sanctions applied by Europe in particular to try and put, you know, a lot more pressure on the Russians. But, you know, the outlook for China is really strong. And clearly, you know, as per other economies that we've seen that have emerged out of, you know, those pandemic sort of restrictions, we've seen a fairly rapid and sharp increase in demand. I mean, it's one commodity where you get that immediate impact of people immediately traveling, you know, around both domestically and internationally as a result of those easing restrictions. And, you know, being out for most of the year with negative growth subsequently, you know, this year should be pretty strong in terms of growth overall for China. In fact, we're expecting to see China provide about 2/3 of global growth in demand in the oil market this year.
Two thirds of global growth demand.
Yeah,
is just coming from China.
Just coming from China. Now that is assuming obviously that the US and Europe are relatively weak, and you know we can explore that a little bit more. I mean, Europe, the situation in Europe has certainly changed after what looked like a pretty grim winter. You know, that's those supply energy shortages. Have certainly eased. So, you know, we're starting to see a little bit more industrial activity now there. And certainly in the US, we had, you know, a house view of a relatively soft landing for the US economy. But, you know, all indications so far has been, you know, it's been running quite strongly. And I suppose that's where the market's, you know, uncertain, I suppose, about whether that will actually induce further rate hikes by the Fed and thus wane on economic activity, or you know, the Fed and its hiking or its monetary policy just won't be able to slow up the economy, and we'll actually see continued strength in demand.
Yeah, I think that we are continuing to see this strength now. Although savings rates in the US haven't been depleted at all. So as they start to move into their summer, and then we get this driving season again, I think that we're going to see spending pick back, well, continue on its way. Probably not at the same exuberance over there, but the US consumer, the US driver, driving season has always been a thing that confuses me about the US. What are you going to do? Russian cuts. Do you think what's your call on how long the Russian cuts to oil, which is it's only about, I think about 0.5% of global oil supply. But do you think that there's any lasting ramifications from the oil cuts? We had the reason I ask is because we had Alec Cutler from Orbis Funds on a couple of weeks ago, who pontificated that a Russian cutting at this time of year, they'd never done it before, and it's going to be almost impossible for them to turn some of these rigs back on, which is interesting that he had that view. He was very bullish on oil, similar to yourself there. You got any view on where the Russian cuts are going to take the world?
Yeah, I mean, there's two issues here at the moment. I mean, clearly, in the shorter term, you know, the actual impact of the sanctions on exports and output. You know, we've seen obviously crude oil exports hold up relatively well, and as I said, you know, that's been driven by you know, additional buying from Asia. I think now that we've seen the implementation of sanctions on refined fuel products, they're going to be a little bit more difficult to mitigate. You know, the refining capacity, particularly for products like diesel, is relatively limited and takes some time, you know, to build up outside of Russia as a consequence of, you know, those bans on exports out of Russia into Europe. So I do feel like, you know, that will have a more lasting impact, but, you know, we're still early days at the moment. Then it's... Then it's that longer-term issue around all of the technology and services impacts that the sanctions are going to have. Bullish on, you know, the longer term impact on output. I cannot see it holding up at these sort of levels on a sustainable basis, for the next few years, considering the constraints on just maintaining current output. You need a lot of capital, a lot of technology, a lot of services just to keep those operations running smoothly, and they've all been throttled quite significantly. So outside of those sanctions in the shorter term, I think you might see a situation similar to Venezuela, where the support of the industry falls away, and you subsequently see a long term decline in output from that country.
Okay, well, now let's just handbrake it a little bit. Similar sort of feel. We're now a year into the war in Ukraine, and the Widowmaker trade. I'll tell you what, if you could say that there was a natural gas shortage in Europe and a prolonged war that has no sign of ending anytime soon, you'd want to be long natural gas and you'd be broke. What's your take on that? Do you think that Europe has got another winter in them to be able to survive this?
Oh, look, it's funny. You know, you can have all of these well analyzed sort of calls, but in the end, you know, an act of God can change them all. And we saw obviously a much warmer winter in Europe result in them, I suppose, dodging the bullet in a sense and coming through relatively unscathed. But that is still a very short term impact, and I think the underlying issue is still around replacing all that lost supply of cheap Russian gas that they're still facing. I think people get a bit skewed by this talk of really high inventories within Europe. The inventory or storage sort of facilities there aren't there to mitigate, I suppose, such large supply shocks. So they're essentially to smooth out sort of small seasonal gains or short term, very short term. I'm talking days in terms of length, supply disruptions. So we're going to be back to square one essentially in the not too distant future, where they're going to have to work out how they are going to survive another winter where will be completely out of Russian gas and competing thus in an international market which is going to be a lot more tighter than it was last year, in part because China wasn't really active in the spot LNG market in particular, because it was it was bunkering down with the COVID-19 virus. So it's going to be even more challenging, I suspect, over the next couple of quarters leading into the 2023-24 winter for Europe. And they're going to have to continue to make some really hard decisions around consumption and, particularly from their from industry, and how they tackle, I suppose, that through the next winter.
I know it's not exactly your front end sort of wheelhouse. I know it's sort of analysis is more your side of things and telling the story that's there. I'm just trying to think about if Europe, I mean, what options are available to Europe? I'm trying to figure out what the trade is here. And obviously that's not your thing to talk about exact specifics, but I'm just trying to think, if you play the tape to the end in Europe, what happens next? Like you said, they've got some hard decisions to make. What are they actually probably going to do?
Well, I mean, it essentially goes down to whether a lot of the industry that particularly countries like Germany were built on that cheap energy. I mean, Russian gas was coming in at single digit dollars per MMBTU, compared to the 15 or 20 or 30 that we've seen in recent times. So is the manufacturing or industrial sector in Europe able to operate with much higher energy costs. And I suppose that will be, you know, the key question they have to ask. I mean, at the moment, they've been able to reduce consumption somewhat over the past few months, but you know, we're still seeing, even with lower gas prices, we're still hearing of, you know.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Heavy industry operations, smelters and the like, shutting down in recent weeks. So, you know, that's going to be something that I'll have to face up to if this is a, you know, a long-term sort of scenario for them.
Yeah, it is funny as well. And just sort of stepping out of it, I haven't gone deep into it, but the German press has started to push heavily onto the Ukraine blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. And sort of pushing that as being a reason why, so you can see that sort of Germany might be starting to edge away from this war, which they were drawn into. And I think that they were just hoping that it would all be over quickly and they wouldn't have to cause a fuss. It's now a year in and they've actually got to make some decisions. And I think that they're really starting to shift away, which would be, you know, awful, I mean, in that regard. But I think that they've just, you're right, they've actually got some serious decisions. We've had Jonathan Payne, former guest on the show, but he's written profusely about the example that he's used is BASF. Chemical manufacturer and a whole bunch of other stuff as well. They basically have a city that, like you were saying, depends on natural gas to come through and then to come to cheaper so they can create everything they need to create. Without that, they can't do it. Everything stops. Everything stops spinning. And how long it can stop spinning for. But you wouldn't think so looking at some of the markets. Well, anyway, we can go into that. We can go into that later. It's a weird sort of situation where we've got that you've got such pain throughout the world in various pressure points, but the market doesn't really seem to be responding the way that you think that it would. It shows they're frustratingly robust at the moment, which is, you know, pays to be bullish. Now, finally, we'll see if we can get into it, or almost finally, we'll crack through. So Chinese reopening, they've talked down what they're going to be doing in 2023 to just above 5% growth. Better than last year, definitely not where it would be for the last three decades, nowhere close. Steel inventories, how do you say it? Inventories or inventories?
Inventories is my take.
Okay, steel inventories. How does the Chinese shift in policy change this week on your play on steel and especially with regards to iron ore? I know that you've got some things here talking about Australian and Brazilian iron ore exports. I just wonder if you'd go into that a touch for us.
Yeah, I mean, the issues in the Chinese steel market have been percolating for some time. And, you know, I never thought the reopening would really rectify a lot of these situations. And that's been supported by subsequent sort of policy measures they've put in place, which really just look at, you know, mitigating potential downside risks to that industry, rather than actually, you know, boosting demand for housing or construction in particular. So, you know, on that side of things, it looks, you know, doesn't look as great, I suppose, as what it potentially could be. And that, for me, suggests that, you know, all of those underlying issues that we were facing really prior to the pandemic or even during the early stages of it are still there. So that's a difficult sort of backdrop for steel and iron ore, which, you know, will continue to manifest itself, I suspect, over the course of this year. But as you sort of hinted, you know, there are issues on the supply side as well. You know, clearly some of the major exporters, BHP Rio's and Vale's, are seeing, I suppose, the longer term flags around demand, and have certainly curtailed a lot of their long term investment in the industry, and as a consequence, you know, the growth in supply has slowed up quite considerably. And then you add in, you know, short term issues, particularly weather related ones, which have certainly impacted supply in the shorter term, and you're not now facing, I suppose, a market which you know, has weakening demand fundamentals and really strong supply growth. It actually looks a little bit more balanced at this point, which is, you know, you don't tend to find a lot of the time. You know, the cycles around supply and demand can, you know, be quite divergent, you know, through the years. So to find, you know, a market which is sort of aligning both on both sides is quite rare. But, you know, for me, you know, if we do see an improvement in supply, and as I said, some of those shorter term issues will be overcome, then, you know, the market is looking a little bit soft, at least in the shorter term. So we're not particularly bullish. In fact, you know, we need to take a step back and look at, you know, the development of an economy. You always find, obviously, you know, the steel and iron ore is really the driver of that initial sort of growth in that economy. Then tends to peter off as it moves down the value chain and becomes a bit more of a services based economy. And I think that's where we find ourselves now with China, in particular, when you look at how you know, Beijing is tackling the reopening with a focus on domestic consumption, which will be driven by, you know, the services sector in particular. So that doesn't, you know, bode well for steel demand, but certainly, as I said, you know, over the longer term, I think we're now sort of not that far off, you know, that peak steel sort of point where, you know, we'll start to see demand obviously weakening and thus, you know, the real driver of you know, Australian trade in particular, you know, will obviously suffer.
Okay, well, I suppose that'll be a negative for the Aussie dollar and some of our big miners as well. Might need to take some more profits on BHP, I suppose, if that's the case, but maybe not now. So you've got, are you still $130 a tonne short term, $100 long term?
Well, $100 essentially by the end of the year. I think, you know, we see a little bit of upside in the shorter term. Yeah, as I said, that the sentiment is picking up in part based on hope. So, you know, we'll see those futures markets probably push a little bit higher. You know, if you do have exposure to it, I would suspect, you know, that's going to be as good as it gets. And then we'll see those issues start to weigh on the price over the course of the year.
Yeah, okay. Well, there's some good play for you on that one. And now, I didn't get a chance to really get my teeth stuck into the note, but there was one that you had here on carbon. I want to say carbon credits, but it's not. Did you want to speak to that as well? I know that it's a hot area, and if it's one that you want to go into a little bit, Daniel, that'd be great just to talk about what it is that you've been talking about lately in that regard. Maybe educate me a little bit on it too, because my awareness of carbon and the markets around it is coming in off a very long run up. In that, you know, I need to do a lot of catching up here. Can you help me catch up on this side?
Look, I think that's the situation. I think a lot of people find themselves in. You know, it's been.
I'm not afraid to put my hand. I've never been afraid to put my hand up and say I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, look, and it is an educational process. I mean, it is a very new area for a lot of people, and the detail, the devil's in the detail in a lot of times. So, you know, we are on a journey where, you know, we're going to learn a lot about this, I think, over the next few years. And look, you know, the carbon market globally, I suppose, has has been a bit of a disjointed sort of effort, considering, you know, it's still very regional or country based at this point. But when you look at Europe in particular, you know, quite a large and liquid market, you know, you can see how potentially, smaller markets like Australia can certainly evolve. And look, it's been a bit of a slow burn for some time, in part because, you know, the government didn't have any real sort of strong compliance measures around the market. The industries that were under the what they call the safeguard mechanism, which is a compliance-based sort of requirement where, you know, if they produce more than a certain level of emissions, then, you know, they have to either offset, obviously reduce that, or offset it by buying these credits. Now, that level was so high that not one single operation under the safeguard mechanism was exceeding those baselines. So there's no incentive for them to reduce emissions. The recent review by Professor Chubb and the government recommendations are dragging that baseline significantly lower and then reducing it year by year by about 5%. And that's where the real kicker will be, that ultimately, in the not too distant future, I'm talking, you know, a couple of years max, where operations will have to have a serious look at either how to reduce their operations or offset that by purchasing these ACCUs, which essentially are based on supply from these projects such as forest regeneration, carbon capture type projects, all these types of renewable energy offset projects. So, that is a real game changer for the Australian carbon market, essentially. And we, you know, once it comes into place, it's supposed to be set into law by the 1st of July this year. Then we're going to have to see, you know, a lot of operations, a lot of companies really face up to the emissions that they produce and how they're going to tackle, I suppose, this rising constraint on that.
Okay. Well, with your permission, I'll put the note that you have on carbon onto the website. So anyone who's on there, just go and click the link. It's in the notes section. It'll be down the bottom of the page on whelandcapital.com. Follow the links to the BIP show under there. With nothing left in the world, I don't want to talk about copper or anything. I think that we've covered enough of the commodities market, and I've talked about copper until the cows have come home. So that's as far as I want to go there. Daniel Hines, commodities from ANZ, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, James. Anytime.
Mate, have yourself a good one. Have a good weekend, and thanks everyone for joining us. You can find us on iTunes at The BIP Show or wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Twitter at @_BIP_show, and we're on Facebook too. Just search for The BIP Show. I've got a website. Just Google Whelan Capital. It's got all of the links and all of the documents that you want to know. Individually, I am at JamesWhelan42 on Twitter. The show is produced by whoever I could find on the day. Thank you very much. We'll catch you next time. This episode might be over, but your ETF investing journey with Global X is only just beginning. The expert team at Global X ETFs is ready to support your goals with their wide suite of ETFs. For the latest updates, follow Global X ETFs on LinkedIn and Twitter at Global X ETFs Australia.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.